one or another service. Even though Secretary of Defense Gates increasingly insisted on having a say in operational matters, in practice he became aware of only those problems that the chiefs unanimously agreed to submit to him. This had to represent a definite judgment on each of their parts that they had more to gain by such a submission than they did by bargaining among themselves. So while many important problems were never brought to the Defense Secretary's attention, one matter that was, however, was the definition of general war to be used in capabilities planning. In June 1960, by my notes, Secretary Gates confirmed the definition, war with the USSR. Since there was to be only one plan for fighting Russians anywhere in the world under any circumstances, including along with SAC, Polaris submarines, and theater forces, Eisenhower endorsed in 1959 the coordination of a single strategic plan at SAC headquarters in Omaha. Annex C of the JSCAP came to be by December 1960 the single integrated operational plan, SIOP. By 1960, the planners of the SIOP, the Joint Strategic Target Planning Staff, had gathered all the general war target lists of the various commands, including SAC, NATO, and PACOM, into one coordinated target list to allocate weapons more efficiently to targets all over the world. A major argument for centering the targeting effort at SAC headquarters was the allegedly unique capabilities of SAC's computers. In reality, these were still at such a rudimentary state of development that much or most of the computation had still to be done by hand, with the aid of calculating machines. Again, there was an intense concern for minimizing the interference or fratricide of vehicles aimed at targets in close proximity. There was also a desire by Eisenhower to reduce duplication of efforts by different commands. In the actual planning, both concerns were totally frustrated. The latter because each command and service was determined to cover important targets by its own forces. By some counts, over 80 weapons were dedicated to Moscow. Other counts put this at 180. Meanwhile, the prevention of interference, as in the Pacific, remained a delusional objective. As with the SINCPAC plan I had read earlier, the coordination involved in this higher-level plan was so complex that there was room for only one real strategy. The price of bringing all the theater and component service plans into harmony with each other, into one plan, was the total elimination of any flexibility in carrying it out. So much planning was involved in producing this one scenario that there was simply no staff or computer time available to produce an alternative. As with the SINCPAC planners I met earlier, the PSYOP planners themselves were appalled at the confusion and chaos that might ensue if any alternative was proposed. Following the guidance of the JSCAP, the planners at SAC headquarters set out to weld all the warheads in the U.S. arsenal into one Hydra-headed monster that would arrive on its targets as near simultaneously as possible, preferably before any Soviet warheads had launched. On strips like Kunsan or Kadena, and on aircraft carriers surrounding the Sino-Soviet bloc, as it was still described in 1961, though China and the Soviets had actually split apart a couple of years before that, more than 1,000 tactical fighter bombers were armed with H-bombs in range of Russia and China. Each of them could devastate a city with one bomb. For a larger metropolitan area, it might take two. Yet until this time, SAC planners had regarded these tactical theater forces as so vulnerable, unreliable, and insignificant a factor in all-out nuclear war that they had not even bothered to include them in calculating the outcome of attacks in a general war. In 1961, there were about 1,700 SAC bombers, including over 600 B-52s and 1,000 B-47s. In the bomb bays of the SAC planes were thermonuclear bombs much larger than those I had seen in Okinawa. Many were from 5 to 25 megatons in yield. Each 25-megaton bomb, with 1,250 times the yield of the fission bomb that destroyed Nagasaki, was the equivalent of 25 million tons of TNT, or over 12 times the total bomb tonnage we dropped in World War II. Within the arsenal, there were some 500 bombs with an explosive power of 25 megatons. Each of these warheads had more firepower than all the bombs and shells exploded in all the wars of human history. These intercontinental bombers and missiles had come to be stationed almost entirely in the continental United States, though they might be deployed to forward bases overseas in a crisis. A small force of B-52s was constantly airborne. Many of the rest were on alert. I had seen a classified film of an incredible maneuver in which a column of B-58s, smaller than B-52s but still intercontinental heavy bombers, taxied down a runway and then took off simultaneously, rather than one at a time. The point, as at Kadena and elsewhere, was to get in the air and away from the field as fast as possible, on warning of an imminent attack, before an enemy missile might arrive. In the time it would normally have taken for a single plane to take off, a squadron of planes would be airborne, on their way to their pre-assigned targets. In the film, these heavy bombers, each as big as an airliner, sped up in tandem as they raced down the airstrip, one behind the other, so close that if one had slackened its pace for an instant, the plane behind, with its full fuel load and its multiple thermonuclear weapons, would have rammed into its tail. Then they lifted together like a flock of birds startled by a gunshot. It was an astonishing sight, beautiful and terrible at once. On carriers, smaller tactical bombers would be boosted on takeoff by a catapult, a kind of large slingshot. But since the General Nuclear War Plan, as I knew, called for takeoff around the world of as many U.S. planes and missiles as were ready at the time of the execute order, as near simultaneously as possible, the preparations contemplated one overall inflexible global attack, as if the entire destructive arsenal of the United States were launched by a single catapult, a slingshot made for Goliath. The pre-planned targets for the whole force included, along with military sites, every city in the Soviet Union and China. There was at least one warhead allocated for every city of 25,000 people or more in the Soviet Union. The military targets, many of them in or near cities, and many only tendentiously described as military, were by far the great majority, since all the cities could be totally destroyed by a small fraction of the attacking vehicles. In 1960 and 1961, it was in reality quite possible, though USAF and CIA missile gap estimates implied otherwise, that not a single nuclear warhead would land on U.S. territory after such an American first strike. Worldwide fallout in the stratosphere from our own strikes would certainly kill Americans, but over so long a time, with radioactivity decaying in the atmosphere on the way over, and deaths from cancer long delayed, that the increase in mortality in any one year might not be statistically perceptible. But our Western European allies in NATO would be quickly annihilated twice over. First from the mobile Soviet medium-range missiles and tactical bombers targeted on them, which our first strike couldn't find and destroy reliably, and second from the close-in fallout from our own nuclear strikes on Soviet bloc territory. John H. Rubel's brief memoir provides a vivid account of the first high-level presentation on the completed PSYOP 62 by one of the handful of civilians who was present on that historic occasion. I quote his description at length, because I don't know of anything else like it in print from an insider. Rubel is the only person exposed to the PSYOP who has recorded, in his comments toward the end, the same emotional reaction to it that I experienced a few months later in the White House, when I saw the JCS estimate of the death toll from our own attacks. The meeting took place near mid-December 1960, at Strategic Air Command, SAC headquarters at Offutt Air Force Base near Omaha, Nebraska, attended by Secretary Gates, Deputy Secretary Jim Douglas, myself, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and a multitude of general officers representing every unified and specified command from all over the world. The PSYOP briefing was held on the floor of the command center at SAC headquarters. The viewers faced a high wall along which enormous panels bearing maps and charts ran on tracks the entire length of the room, perhaps 100 feet or so. Behind and over one floor up was a glass-enclosed balcony. The generals would run SAC's part of the war from up there behind a long line of desks, glued to telephones, peering through the enclosing glass at the maps depicting the scene of wartime activity somewhere, indeed anywhere and perhaps almost everywhere in the world. At a signal from General Power, the SAC commander, the briefer stepped on stage, as it were, directly facing his audience about 15 or 20 feet in front of the first row. After presenting a few charts, he came to one defining the first wave of attacks to reach the Soviet Union. As I recall, these came from carrier-based fighter bombers stationed near Okinawa. Having made this disclosure, he stepped aside. Thereupon, two airmen appeared, one from each side of the long wall lined with maps, each carrying a tall stepladder. Each airman stopped at the edge of the large map, which, we now observed, showed China and the Soviet Union, and probably some other nearby features on a heroic scale. Each man climbed his tall ladder at the same brisk rate, reaching the top at the same instant as his counterpart. Each reached up toward a red ribbon, which we now noticed encircled a large roll of clear plastic. With a single motion, each untied the bow knot securing the ribbon at his end of the roll, whereupon the plastic sheet unrolled with a whoosh, flapped a bit, and then dangled limply in front of the map. A bunch of little marks appeared, most of them over Moscow, representing nuclear explosions. The men descended the ladders, folded them, carried them off, and disappeared. The briefer repeated this performance several times, as successive waves from B-52s already aloft on Head Start, airborne alert missions, and fighter bombers from carriers in the Mediterranean, and from U.S. bases in Germany, and others from carriers and bases around Japan, and B-47s and B-52s launched from bases in the United States, and some from bases in Europe, and a few ballistic missiles, many more would become part of the plan during the next few years, dropped their lethal loads over the USSR. Each time the briefer described an attack wave, the ballet of the ladder masters would be reenacted. They would untie another pair of red ribbons, a plastic roll would come whooshing down, and Moscow would be even further obliterated beneath the little marks on those layers of plastic sheets. There were little marks on other places, too, but somebody noted that a third of Soviet industrial military strength was concentrated in the greater Moscow area, hence the concentration of bombs dropped on that region. I recall that the plan called for a total of 40 megatons. Megatons on Moscow, about 4,000 times more than the bomb over Hiroshima, and perhaps 20 to 30 times more than all the non-nuclear bombs dropped by the Allies in both theaters during more than 4 years of World War II. At the point in the briefing where some bombers were described flying northeast from the Mediterranean on their way to Moscow, General Power waved at the speaker saying, "Just a minute, just a minute." Then he turned in his front row chair to stare into the obscurity of uniforms and dusk stretching behind me, and said, "I just hope none of you have any relatives in Albania, because they have a radar station there that is right on our flight path, and we take it out." With that, to which the response was utter silence, Power turned to the speaker and with another wave of the hand told him to go ahead. A subsequent chart shown by the briefer displayed deaths on the vertical axis, and time in hours extending out to weeks along the horizontal axis. He announced that there were about 175 million people in the USSR. This chart depicted the deaths from fallout alone, not from the direct effects of blast or radiation from a bomb going off, just from fallout subsequent to the attacks, when radioactive dust propelled to high altitudes by the initial blast begins to fall back to Earth. The curve of deaths, rising as time went by, leveled off at about 100 million, showing that more than half the population of the Soviet Union would be killed from radioactive fallout alone. The briefing was soon concluded, to be followed by an identical one covering the attack on China, given by a different speaker. Eventually, he too arrived at a chart showing deaths from fallout alone. "There are about 600 million Chinese in China," he said. His chart went up to half that number, 300 million on the vertical axis. It showed the deaths from fallout as time passed after the attack leveled out at that number, 300 million, half the population of China. A voice out of the gloom from somewhere behind me interrupted, saying, "May I ask a question?" General Power turned again in his front row seat, stared into the darkness, and said, "Yeah, what is it?" in a tone not likely to encourage the timid. "What if this isn't China's war?" the voice asked. "What if this is just a war with the Soviets? Can you change the plan?" "Well, yeah," said General Power resignedly. "We can, but I hope nobody thinks of it, because it would really screw up the plan." Rubel comments. That exchange did it. Already oppressed by the briefings up to that point, I shrank within, horrified. I thought of the Wannsee Conference in January 1942, when an assemblage of German bureaucrats swiftly agreed on a program to exterminate every last Jew they could find anywhere in Europe, using methods of mass extermination more technologically efficient than the vans filled with exhaust gases, the mass shootings, or incineration in barns and synagogues used until then. I felt as if I were witnessing a comparable descent into the deep heart of darkness, a twilight underworld, governed by disciplined, meticulous, and energetically mindless groupthink, aimed at wiping out half the people living on nearly one-third of the Earth's surface. Those feelings have not entirely abated, even though more than 40 years have passed since that dark moment. The next morning, as Rubel relates, Secretary of Defense Gates called a meeting to discuss the proceedings of the previous evening. The chiefs were there, I was there, and the secretaries of the Army, Navy, and Air Force joined the group, starting with the chairman of the JCS, General Lyman Lemnitzer. Each of these discussants said much the same thing. The men had done a very fine job, a very difficult job, and that they should be commended for their work. Gates, thank heaven, never turned to me. I had no idea what I would say if he did. I should have, but fear I would not have had the courage to say that this was the most barbaric, unthinkable, crazy so-called plan I had ever heard and could never have imagined. One person alone at the second session raised objections. It was the Commandant of the Marine Corps, David M. Shoup, who had earned the Congressional Medal of Honor for commanding from the beach the Marines who landed at Tarawa. 5 years before this briefing, I had heard him address my graduating class in the Infantry Basic School in the Marine Corps at Quantico. From 1961 to the end of the war, he opposed vigorously our intervention in Vietnam. "All I can say is," Shoup said in a level voice, "any plan that murders 300 million Chinese when it might not even be their war is not a good plan. That is not the American way." It was, however, the American plan. Though President Eisenhower was distressed when his science advisor, George Kistiakowsky, reported to him the tremendous amount of overkill in the plan, Eisenhower endorsed the plan and passed it on without any modification to John F. Kennedy a month later. It was my passion to change it. Chapter 7. Briefing Bundy. It wasn't only the handful of civilians exposed to the single integrated operational plan. I actually knew no others at the time, such as Rubel, who felt that this insane plan must be radically changed. Through my contact with Air Force staff, I became aware that a number of Air Force planning officers were concerned about the madness of the planning process and current plans. But insofar as these plans were determined by their higher-level superiors, these men were unable to influence the plan through ordinary command channels. In principle, the same was true for me and for Rand. During this period, Rand did not work for the Secretary of Defense, but rather for the Air Force. Thus, only by going out of channels in a way that would directly threaten the budget and existence of their institution, could RAND researchers and officers have made the Secretary of Defense aware of the situation. Yet I came increasingly to feel it was essential that the President and the Secretary of Defense be made aware of the nature of the general war planning system, with all its attendant risks of increasing the likelihood of war, and the likelihood that any sizable war involving Russian troops would trigger multi-genocidal effects on an almost unimaginable scale throughout the world. It seemed essential to me that the President himself have before his eyes, for the first time, the actual Joint Strategic Capabilities Plan, so that he could read it in context with the PSYOP and become aware of the extreme simplicity, not to mention rigidity, stupidity, and incredible bloody-mindedness of these plans. The extremity of these qualities, I felt, was impossible to convey without examining the written plans. For several years, one of my highest objectives for my own personal influence on national defense was moving a few pieces of paper from one level of authority to a higher one, from a military to a civilian level. In particular, I wanted to move one document, the JSCAP with its Annex C, from the offices of the Joint Staff, or Air Staff, to the office of the Secretary of Defense and to the Oval Office, so that civilian authority could become aware of and then act to control and change the nature of our general war plans. A decade later, my personal objective was very similar, with a different level of civilian authority in mind. I wanted to move 7,000 top-secret pages, the Pentagon Papers, from the Pentagon and RAND to the Senate and the American public. I also wanted to make civilian authority aware of the extreme degree of reliance on delegation, as well as all the other risks of unauthorized action I had discovered. Unfortunately, I had no direct line of access to Secretary Gates. In 1960, after returning from the Pacific Command and Control study, I came into contact with two people who were widely rumored to be future officials in the Kennedy administration. One was Paul Nitze, who took part in a RAND-sponsored conference on alternative military strategy at Asilomar in Monterey. During a break in the conference, I spent a long drive to and from visiting Big Sur in the back seat of a car with Nitze. He had been the drafter of the famous National Security Council paper NSC 68, which had been the planning basis for our armament buildup in 1950. He was now head of the Committee on Foreign Policy of the Democratic Advisory Council, DAC, the main Democratic figure on military political planning. He was expected to become a high official. I spent the time in the car explaining to him how important it was that the President personally come to read, take an interest in, and insist on monitoring and supervising the general war plans, though I didn't describe them to him in detail. He had top-secret clearance. He had briefly served as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs under Eisenhower, and he remained a consultant. Nevertheless, according to the rules of the game, at that moment he had no need to know this sensitive information. Nor did I, technically speaking. The fact that some staff colonels had thought otherwise didn't mean that I could go around telling others who weren't officials. For the same reason, I hadn't informed any of my RAND colleagues on these matters. To Nitze, I simply emphasized at length the urgency of the problem, and that if he should become an official in the new administration, he should see to it that the President immediately inform himself on these matters. I gave the same message to Walt Rostow, who, like Nitze, was a member of the DAC Committee on Foreign Policy, and was also expected to be a national security official if Kennedy won the election. I met Rostow during the Kennedy campaign at a meeting of advisors on policy speeches convened at the Harvard Law School by Archibald Cox, a professor at the school. During a long break, I spoke to Rostow in the law school's parking lot, repeating what I had told Nitze. I urged that if Rostow were ever close to the future president, in 1961 he did become an aide to McGeorge Bundy in the White House, he must ensure that the president asked to see the JSCAP and its Annex C. In January 1961, as a result of my help in arranging for RAND researchers to give input on speechwriting for Kennedy during the campaign, I was invited to the inaugural ball in Washington. On the Monday after the inauguration, I went to see Paul Nitze in his new office as, again, Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, ISA. I reminded him of our conversation the previous fall in Monterey. "Now that you're in office, I can tell you the details of these plans," I said. The ISA Assistant Secretary was in charge of policy planning in the Defense Department, and he was the natural official to deal with any kinds of plans, although in practice the office had never dealt with operational military plans before. As a result of this conversation, Nitze asked to see the JSCAP, through Harry Rowan, my close friend and former RAND colleague, who was now NHTSA's Deputy Assistant Secretary for Planning and Policy. Harry passed the mission to me as an ISA consultant from RAND. I went to see the military officer in charge of plans under Rowan, an Army general who had been in that office for some time in the previous administration. I asked him to get me the JSCAP for Rowan and NHTSA. He curtly refused. He said bluntly, "You have no need to know." More challengingly, when I reiterated that this was at the request of his boss, the assistant secretary, he said, "He has no need to know either." I asked him if he himself had ever seen it, and he said that he had, but as an Army general, not in his capacity as an official within ISA. I reported this to Harry, his immediate superior. NHTSA didn't get the JSCAP. Later that first month, Rowan arranged for me to see McGeorge Bundy, Assistant to the President for National Security, to brief him on the war plans and on the command and control problems I had discovered in the Pacific. I was ushered into Bundy's office by Bob Comer, his deputy. I had never met Bundy, who had been dean of faculty at Harvard while I was a graduate student in the Society of Fellows, of which he had been a member a decade earlier. I had met Comer several times before when he had visited RAND. I had an hour scheduled with Bundy. As I walked in, I started to worry that he was likely to be skeptical or suspicious of the fact that, as a civilian, I seemed to know so much about war plans. I felt that I ought to begin by giving him some hints as to how I had acquired this information. I began to talk of my participation in the SYNCPAC command and control project, and my work with the joint staff. After 2 or 3 minutes of this, he interrupted me in a dry, frosty tone with the question, "Is this a briefing or a confessional?" He was famous for his arrogance with intellectual inferiors, most people, and for curtly cutting off subordinates who weren't giving him information crisply enough. I thought to myself, "All right, wise guy, you asked for it." I told him crisply that there was a lot about the war plans and nuclear operations that he probably didn't know. I proceeded to tick off the characteristics of the JSCAP, including its nature as a first-strike plan, and its city-busting targeting of the Sino-Soviet bloc under all circumstances, and the defects in the control system. I had the satisfaction, within a few minutes, of seeing his mouth drop open. He began to take furious notes, shaking his head and exclaiming under his breath. Throughout and at the end of my briefing, he kept me there nearly another hour, I gave him recommendations, all of which he noted down. The first was that he should assert his authority to get a hold of the JSCAP, then read it, familiarize himself with it, and begin to work on it with the help of military aides, who could explain the underlying controversies and the operational implications. I told him of the LST with nuclear weapons at Iwakuni, the general violations of the two-man rule, and the universal lack of physical controls, any form of locks, on nuclear weapons. In particular, as a matter for urgent White House concern, I described the widespread belief, contrary not only to public declarations, but also to assertions in top-secret planning, that President Eisenhower had delegated authority to initiate nuclear attacks in a variety of circumstances. Bundy, who had been in office only a couple of weeks at this point, showed every sign of surprise and shock at this news, though not disbelief. I told him of the purported letters from President Eisenhower to the unified and specified commanders. I said I hadn't seen them myself, but I did know that important officers in the Pacific believed they existed, and that their belief had dangerous consequences. It had led to sub-delegation far below the level of the theater commanders. Probably, I presumed, far more widely than President Eisenhower was aware or had intended. Some 40 years later, I was to learn from newly declassified documents from the late 1950s that I had been mistaken about this. To my great surprise, it turned out that Eisenhower had actually foreseen and authorized this sub-delegation, dangerous as this seemed to me. But if I had known this at the time, I wouldn't have changed my recommendations to Bundy. The risks of having so many subordinate commanders with both the ability and the presumed right to take nuclear initiatives in crisis conditions seemed so great that it was urgent for President Kennedy to bring his own judgment to bear and take steps to reestablish his control of the system. A few days after my briefing to Bundy, Harry Rowan told me that he and Bundy had agreed that the question of delegation was an important subject to investigate. Bundy could see nothing in the files available to him that supported what I had described, but he already knew that this was not conclusive, since Eisenhower had taken most of his White House files with him. At an NSC staff meeting, Bundy announced that a joint White House-DOD committee of one, namely Daniel Ellsberg, was being formed to investigate the problem of presidential authorization of the use of nuclear weapons. My task, Rowan told me, was to find out whether the letters I had heard about actually existed. I would have full authority, which would be confirmed by the White House, to go anywhere, ask anything, see anything, bearing on this effort. My first visit was to Commander Tazewell Shepard, Jr., President Kennedy's naval aide in charge of the nuclear alert procedures, and the one who carried the nuclear football. I told him what I had heard in the Pacific. He said it was news to him, and seemed genuinely convinced that it was baseless. He confirmed that, as the president's liaison with the nuclear command and control system, he was the one who ought to know if such letters existed. He swore that he had never heard of them. Moreover, he said, he had no knowledge of any authorization having been given in any form to any of the unified or specified commanders for executing their war plans in the absence of an express presidential order. He felt that if such an authorization existed, he would have known about it. By that time, I was experienced enough to know that an officer in his position could and would lie convincingly about such matters in the interest of secrecy. But my best judgment in this circumstance was that he was trying to be helpful, and that he was being honest with me. He knew that my authority to ask questions and get straight answers came from Bundy, and it didn't make sense that he would want to deceive the president's assistant. Shepard undertook to ask others working at the presidential command post in the White House about the issues I raised. Everyone he asked denied knowledge of any of these issues. He then arranged for me to visit the underground command posts involved in disseminating nuclear directives in the event of nuclear war. One of these was the Alternate Joint Communication Center, which served as an alternate command center for the JCS inside Raven Rock Mountain, 40 miles from Washington. Others were High Point, under another mountain, supposed to house the civilian leaders of the government during a nuclear emergency, and Camp David, the presidential retreat in Maryland. Shepard asked me to let him know whatever I found out. But the officers in those centers claimed to be just as ignorant as he was of any such delegation, nor did they seem to be aware of the widespread assumption in the Pacific that such an authorization existed. In addition, I talked to officers in charge at the White House Situation Room. They all felt that they ought to know if someone other than the president was authorized to start a nuclear war. They felt sure that they would know if that were the case. But they said they didn't know. Again, none of them was aware that this was widely believed in the Pacific. Meanwhile, Shepard reported back to me that his own further investigation had failed to disclose any evidence of pre-delegation. I concluded, tentatively, that the belief in the Pacific was based on a myth that was clearly important to dispel. Of course, I couldn't be definitive about such a negative finding. It was a matter of my judgment that Shepard and the other officers were not deceiving me, and that such an authorization, still less actual letters, probably could not have been passed to the commanders before Shepard's arrival, without Shepard being able to find any hint of it and without any of the others knowing about it. I reported this to McGeorge Bundy's new deputy, Carl Kaysen. Kaysen, a professor of economics at Harvard and a former junior fellow himself, had read my honors thesis at Harvard and recommended me for the Society of Fellows. I explained my puzzlement at the situation. I had failed to find anyone in the Washington area, where the supposed delegation had been made, and where the highest level command was exercised, who had even heard that anyone anywhere believed that someone outside Washington was authorized to launch nuclear attacks on his own. Yet there seemed no reason to doubt either that officers in the Pacific believed that such a delegation had been made, or that lower-level sub-delegation had actually occurred. there were several possibilities to explain this discrepancy. I told Kaysen that my best judgment was that the officers in the Pacific were misled. The supposed letters from Eisenhower probably did not exist. But I felt quite sure that the belief in the letters was real, and that it had real consequences, dangerous ones, which needed correcting. It provided a false precedent for the lower-level delegations that SINCPAC and perhaps others were reported to have made, which I was quite sure did exist. If the Eisenhower letters did exist, after all, the precedent was not false, but just as dangerous in its effects. Either way, a dangerous situation remained that Kennedy needed to address. About a month later, in late June or early July 1961, I was in Kaysen's office in the Executive Office Building when he mentioned to me, "By the way, we found your black notebook." "What notebook?" I hadn't heard of a notebook, and I hadn't mentioned one to him. "The one with the letters from Eisenhower." He pointed to a loose-leaf notebook on a table by his window. He told me there were copies in it of letters signed by Eisenhower to each of the theater commanders, along with SAC and NORAD, who controlled nuclear weapons, specifying circumstances under which they were authorized to use nuclear weapons without immediate presidential authorization. He said the circumstances included the need, in their judgment, for fast action at a time when communications were out with Washington. But they weren't limited entirely to that. They also provided for situations when the president was physically incapacitated, as during Eisenhower's stroke. That didn't seem to allow for command to be reserved for the Secretary of Defense, who was second in the chain of command by the National Security Act of 1958. But these letters were originally sent in 1957. I should have asked to read the actual letters, but I didn't. Nor did I press for details when I asked him how he had found them. He just told me he hadn't been entirely satisfied by my conclusions, and had kept probing, and the notebook had finally turned up. I asked, "What has the president decided to do?" "Nothing. He's not doing anything. He's letting them stand." This wasn't what I wanted to hear. I asked, "Why is he doing that?" Kaysen said, "This is not the time for Lieutenant Kennedy to reverse the decision of the great general." Lieutenant was Kennedy's naval rank in World War II. In all his campaigns, he had run as a war hero. But that status had been earned after he had allowed his PT boat to be cut in two by a Japanese destroyer. Kennedy might now be commander-in-chief, but he had never been supreme commander of Allied forces in Europe, and it wasn't the time, Kaysen was saying, for him to be disagreeing with the prior judgment of the general who had been. It was not the time for it. I could understand the politics of this, both bureaucratic and diplomatic. It was just after the debacle of the Bay of Pigs and reports of JFK's weak performance at the Vienna summit with Khrushchev. But it still jarred me. It meant that Kennedy and the NSC were not going to look into or do anything about the problem that seemed to me the greatest danger, the sub-delegations and the general looseness of control below the level of the four-star admiral or general. If I'd been asked, I would have urged Kaysen and Bundy to make sure that this time the letters ruled out, or at least limited, further delegation. But that would have meant a confrontation with the military over the issue of sub-delegation, just as sharp as the one to be expected if Kennedy had tried to withdraw Ike's delegation to SINCPAC, SINCSAC, and the other unified and specified commanders. General Loris Norstad at NATO and others would have leaked to Republicans in Congress to raise in closed hearings, which would in turn have leaked to the public, that Kennedy was not only contradicting their own judgment of the requirements of national security, but was also reversing the decision of the great general. Precisely to compensate for an impression of inexperience after the events of the last few months, Kennedy just then named as Chief of Staff of the Air Force General Curtis LeMay, the man with the toughest militarist image in the armed forces. This despite the fact that a number of observers, including Robert Kennedy, would report incidents when certain military men, LeMay above all, would give Kennedy the impression that they were essentially insane, madly reckless, or out of touch with reality. These included, the next year, LeMay's strongly worded advice on the Sunday morning in 1962, when Khrushchev announced he was dismantling his missiles in Cuba, that the president should go ahead and attack Cuba anyway. Yet it was Kennedy who had named LeMay as chief of staff of the Air Force on June 30, 1961, and kept him there. In the fall of 1961, as part of my work for General Earl E. Partridge's Working Group on Presidential Command and Control, I made an appointment to interview the Air Force Chief of Staff. I had mentioned the upcoming interview to Kaysen, and he asked if he might accompany me, having never met the legendary LeMay. In the course of our talk, I asked LeMay how concerned he had been as commander of SAC about the possibility of a surprise attack by a Soviet submarine on Washington. He said calmly that he had felt satisfied with his authority as SINCSAC to carry out his plans in that event, which was clearly a reference to the Eisenhower delegation that I had reported on at the start of the year, and which Kaysen had confirmed. But before I could pursue that, the first face-to-face reference to delegated authority from a military officer I had heard outside the Pacific Command, LeMay took the discussion into territory I had never explored before. "Suppose that Washington had not been hit," he said, when warning of an enemy attack came in. "Should the president be part of the decision process at all?" he asked us, "even if he were alive and in communication?" Neither Kaysen nor I had ever heard that question raised before. We waited for him to continue, which he seemed to have expected. He rolled a cigar at the corner of his mouth in a way I'd seen imitated by some of his staff officers. His ever-present half-smoked cigar gave him a tough look, befitting his reputation. I learned later that he used it to disguise a touch of Bell's palsy. Speaking gruffly, he asked rhetorically, "After all, who was more qualified to make that decision, of whether to go to nuclear war on the basis of warning? Some politician who may have been in office for only a couple of months, or a man who has been preparing all his adult life to make it?" Both his lips and his voice curled contemptuously around the words, "some politician." The P was an explosive puff, and the personal reference seemed pointed. This was the first year of the current politician's presidential term, in which Lieutenant Kennedy had held back air support from his beleaguered invasion force at the Bay of Pigs, and, as I learned later, the year he had refrained from knocking down the new Berlin Wall, and then refused to send combat troops to Vietnam, having earlier rejected sending them to Laos. The general making the comment, for years the commander of the Strategic Air Command, was the man who had planned and directed the immolation of 100,000 Japanese civilians in the firebombing of Tokyo on March 9th and 10th, 1945, and 5 months after that had commanded the atomic bomb strikes on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I never found out why I had been unable to confirm the existence of the letters myself earlier. When I raised the issue much later with Tazewell Shepard, by then a Navy captain, after Kaysen had turned up the notebook, he assured me convincingly that he hadn't been kidding me. He really hadn't known of their existence when I asked. If I hadn't run across the issue in the Pacific and raised it with Bundy when I did, it's possible that no one in the White House would have known of it for a long time. Meanwhile, my new access to the White House made it possible to tie up another loose end. In April 1961, I told Harry Rowan about the situation in Iwakuni. His boss, Paul Nitze, was in charge of military liaison with foreign countries, including base rights. He had the civilian authority under Secretary McNamara for dealing with our relations with Japan and the question of possible treaty violation at Iwakuni that I'd been told about. Harry asked me to describe the problem in writing for Nitze, and to do all the typing myself for special security within the office. Thus, I typed out a memo and stamped it, "Top Secret, Eyes Only for Paul Nitze." Eyes Only was not a classification, but a handling designation indicating that this was not for routine distribution within an agency or office, and was not to be copied or shown to anyone other than the specific addressees listed in the heading. It was for their eyes only. The need for special handling within the office was that ISA was staffed largely with active-duty military officers from various services. In theory, their immediate current loyalty was to ISA and its boss, but in practice their careers depended on their relations with past and future superiors in their home service. They tended to keep those channels open and inform their service headquarters privately of anything that might concern them. In this case, where the Navy or Marines might take strong objection to a decision by NHTSA to change their practices, it was important to delay their finding out what might be coming from the Assistant Secretary. I wrote in detail all that I knew about the nuclear weapons on the USS San Joaquin County and how I had come to know it. I also provided an exhaustive analysis of the pros and cons, since anyone first hearing of such an anomaly would tend to assume there must be some highly technical reason justifying it. I reported that, to the officers aware of it in the theater, there was evidently no strategic or technical rationale at all for the arrangement. No tangible military advantage counterbalancing what they saw as obvious diplomatic risks. The reason the Marine planes on Iwakuni were provided such ready access to nuclear weapons was simply that their landing strip was near the beach. The Marines were part of the Navy, and they practiced in amphibious operations, and the Navy was able and willing to provide them secretly with a nearby LST, landing ship tank. Presumably, the Air Force wasn't tempted to do something similar for its own planes, because it wasn't practical to keep, say, a KC-97 tanker loaded with nuclear weapons flying continuously above an Air Force base in Japan. It wasn't even as though a large number of Navy bases were benefited by this arrangement. This violation of the treaty affected only a handful of weapons at one base, yet the political risk was virtually the same as if it had been a lot of bases. NHTSA had my memo staffed out. He assigned his assistant Timothy Stanley to investigate the problem, and Stanley had me rewrite my report for other staffers. Eventually, I was shown various reports that came out of this. All the facts I had presented were confirmed. The foreign affairs specialist within ISA also corroborated that the situation was a clear-cut violation of both the letter and the spirit of our security treaty with Japan. In these responses, Iwakuni was contrasted with marginal cases, like the carrier visits and even the possibility of our emergency alert plans being executed. The San Joaquin County was a permanent arrangement. It couldn't even be said to be in the waters, not on the territory, since the ship was so close to shore that it would be regarded by every legal test as being on the territory of Japan. The answers also corroborated the extreme diplomatic risks this situation involved, and concluded that it was highly urgent to correct this situation immediately. But a new piece of information came in as well. One of the staffers reported that, on first investigating the situation, he went to the Special Assistant to the Secretary of Defense for Atomic Weapons and Atomic Energy, Gerald W. Johnson, who was responsible for knowing the current whereabouts of every individual nuclear weapon in the world, including test devices and weapons under production. The Special Assistant possessed an enormous loose-leaf notebook that contained the reported current location of every operational weapon in the world. No weapons were listed in Japan. No ship carrying weapons was listed as stationed there. In fact, the book contained no indication that a situation such as I described existed. When NHTSA's investigator pressed the point, Johnson, whose job as a direct representative of the Secretary of Defense afforded him very high status, picked up the phone and called his Navy counterpart to check on it. He was told that there was no such situation, that my story had no basis. However, in pursuing the name I had supplied for the LST, NHTSA's man soon discovered that the San Joaquin County was listed in Navy records as homeported in Okinawa. By further interviews, he discovered that it was being carried that way in Navy reporting, precisely as a cover to deceive the Special Assistant and his boss about the fact that it was permanently based in Iwakuni, except for a few months every 3 years when it was in Okinawa for repairs and overhaul. By coincidence, at the very time of this investigation, it was back in Okinawa undergoing its triennial refitting, which would take another month or so. Deceiving the Secretary of Defense on the whereabouts of a nuclear weapon was the highest imaginable offense within the bureaucracy. No one reading this report could miss that point. It was not within the rules of the bureaucratic game in the remotest sense. But there was an obvious bureaucratic solution. All that had to be done was to keep the LST home in Okinawa. Nitz's staff recommended that he take this up immediately with McNamara. A directive was drafted for him to give McNamara, ordering the ship not to return to Japan. McNamara signed and sent it to the Chief of Naval Operations, CNO, the Navy Chief of Staff, Admiral Arleigh Burke. Harry Rowan told me what happened next. Soon after the directive went out from McNamara, Nitz happened to be at a meeting in McNamara's office on another matter, along with Admiral Burke. At the end of the meeting, Burke asked Nitz to return with him to Burke's office in a different part of the Pentagon. When they arrived at the office, Burke sat down at his desk. Nitz saw immediately that he had in front of him a burn copy, the predecessor to the Xerox copy, a somewhat fuzzy duplicate on tan flimsy paper, of my top-secret eyes-only memo, which was intended for Nitz alone and wasn't supposed to be copied. It was obvious that some commander or captain or rear admiral working for Nitz had seen my memo, burned it, and delivered the copy to Admiral Burke. He also had on the desk a copy of the ISA investigative report, along with McNamara's directive to him. Burke started discussing my memo and the report, not bothering to explain what they were doing on his desk. Burke was furious, Nitz told Harry. Burke was famously given to rages, but this one, in front of an assistant secretary of defense, was surprising to Nitz. Burke made no attempt to deny the facts of the reports or to justify anything. The only thing he had to say in a fury was, "What did you think you were doing as a civilian interfering with the operations of ships of the U.S. Navy?" The fact that this ship was in violation of one of our most important security treaties and was posing enormous diplomatic risks, that it was carrying nuclear weapons in violation of regulations on their whereabouts and in deliberate deception of the Secretary of Defense, that the special assistant to the Secretary had been lied to by the Navy, none of these points was addressed by Burke, nor was he willing to hear about them. He maintained that it was absolutely unacceptable that the Secretary of Defense should presume to tell the Navy where to put its ships. Rowan got the impression that Nitz left the office quite shaken by Burke's willingness to confront him in this way, but determined to have the Navy brought into line. He himself wasn't in a clear-cut command position with respect to Burke, except as he was accepted as a direct representative of the Secretary. So everything depended on McNamara standing by his directive and backing Nitz on this issue. Rowan told me that Nitz went to McNamara and told him that this was of the highest urgency, and that he should order Burke to comply with his directive and with the treaty. I asked Harry, "So what's happened?" McNamara decided to withdraw the directive. He backed off. With all the fights he's having with the services, he didn't want to add this one. I asked, "Does McNamara know he was lied to by the Navy?" "Yes," Harry said. "That's what made him furious in the first place. It's what got him to send the directive." But faced with Nitz's account of Burke's own rage, McNamara had to pick his fights, which included a struggle over the number of nuclear-powered carriers. In this case, I could guess, he would face the likelihood that the Navy would leak the dispute to a friendly committee in Congress, in distorted fashion, and make him defend himself from the charge he was unduly entering into operations by ordering around individual ships. I myself was faced with questions from the Vice President of RAND, Richard Goldstein, when I returned to California. General LeMay had recently sat in on a meeting of the Air Force Advisory Board, which controlled the RAND budget. Goldstein called me into his office and said, "Dan, this is hard to believe, but we have a charge here from General LeMay. He's been told by Admiral Burke that you have been giving the Navy orders on how to operate a destroyer squadron. Is this possible?" I said, "What?" It was true that most of the things I was doing in Washington would look madly presumptuous to most military officers. But I told him I had never done anything remotely like that. It took a second or two to guess what he must be referring to. The mention of Burke was the tip-off. I told Goldstein the whole story, and he passed it on. No one reprimanded me, though I learned that Burke had asked LeMay to have me fired from RAND. The San Joaquin County went back to Iwakuni from Okinawa, with its cargo of nuclear weapons. A couple of years later, NHTSA made another abortive attempt to move it, but it stayed until 1966, when Edwin Reischauer, our ambassador to Japan, learned of its presence, through a leak to his office, and demanded that it be removed. He threatened to resign if it wasn't. In 1967, it finally moved back to Okinawa. Chapter 8. My War Plan. Meanwhile, throughout the spring of 1961, I was working on a project that Harry Rowan had passed on to me. He had been asked by his boss, Paul NHTSA, to draft the new Basic National Security Policy, BNSP, for the Department of Defense. President Eisenhower had initiated this series of annual top-secret policy documents to serve as the civilian authority's statement on the objectives and guidelines for all war planning within the Department of Defense. Under Eisenhower, each BNSP, usually no more than 3 or 4 pages, had embodied the new look and massive retaliation doctrines of John Foster Dulles and chairman of the JCS, Arthur W. Radford. These emphasized main but not sole reliance on nuclear weapons, as opposed to conventional or non-nuclear weapons. In fact, this emphasis was expressed in a trend by Eisenhower officials of describing nuclear weapons themselves as conventional. For some years as a senator, John Kennedy had been associated with a critique of massive retaliation and an espousal of what General Maxwell Taylor, chairman of the JCS, called a strategy of flexible response. Thus, following JFK's election as president, it was understood in the Pentagon that a significant change in the policy directives guiding war planning was in order. It was assumed that this would take the form of a radically revised basic national security policy. Already in February, Bill Kaufman of the RAND Social Science Department had briefed Secretary of Defense McNamara on some proposals within the Air Staff, aimed at moving away from what our RAND colleague Herman Kahn labeled a spasm concept of general war, or as he often put it, referring to its all-out, nothing-held-back character, a wargasm. Kaufman had pressed instead for developing a capability for sustained and controlled warfighting, focused mainly on military targets, with cities withheld from initial attack. In the eyes of advocates in the Air Force, which did not include LeMay, this was a strategy aimed as much at their service rivals in the Navy as it was at the Soviet Union. The sub-launched missiles on Polaris submarines, after all, were smaller than those on Air Force land-based ICBMs, and much smaller than those on bombers. They were also, in the days before GPS systems, much less accurate than either of those vehicles. While the relatively invulnerable Polaris missiles were well-suited to a deterrent policy aimed at targeting cities, they were less effective against hardened military targets, like silo-based ICBMs, of which the Soviets had none in 1961, but were expected shortly to have hundreds to thousands. For that strategy, the Air Force bombers and missiles had an advantage. In fact, the only role in which they had a relative advantage was as counterforce weapons, limiting damage to the United States in an all-out first strike, by destroying Soviet land-based missiles before they were launched. Naturally, this was the preferred Air Force position, and after hearing Kaufman's briefing on the arguments, McNamara had seemed sympathetic. It would have been natural, then, for Harry to assign Kaufman, who was also, like me, working as an ISA consultant in Washington at this time, to draft the general war section of the new BNSP. But somewhat to my surprise, Rowan asked me to draft that section, and instead assigned Kaufman the task of drafting a section on limited nuclear war. I knew that my own views as to what the policy should be were closer to Rowan's attitudes than Kaufman's on the importance of counterforce, and I presume that was why I was given the job. This encouraged me to undertake the drafting as a process of refining my own views and making them as specific as possible, with the expectation that the end result would probably be acceptable to Rowan. That must have been his expectation, too, because the only directive he had given me was, "Write what you think the guidance should be." That's what I proceeded to do. the Air Force concept of war fighting or damage limiting, limiting damage to the United States from Soviet offensive nuclear forces, involved prolonged and controlled counterforce attacks on a military target system in the Soviet Union and its satellites in Eastern Europe. That included precise attacks against hardened missile sites and command and control centers. Along with our land-based ICBMs, this concept called for increased numbers of high-performance bombers, capable of penetrating Russian defenses, by either flying